You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
But that's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
There's going to be a lot of people who are saying, rest in peace, Donald Trump. This is the end of Donald Trump. It's completely misguided, in my opinion. I don't think we've seen any evidence to support such declarative statements.
That's Jonathan Swan. He's a national political correspondent at Axios, covering both the White House and Congress. Swan made a name for himself during the Trump years as one of the most plugged-in reporters in Washington, and he continues to cover the former president closely, including his legal troubles, his planned campaign, and his emerging battle with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I spoke with Swan on the afternoon of November 9th, less than 24 hours after the polls closed on Election Day. We discussed the early lessons of the midterms and what they mean for Trump, Biden, and the country. That's coming up. Stay tuned.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
Support for this show comes from NetSuite. Growth can be wonderful, but it comes with complications, like finding that new pair of shoes for your kids when they get too big, or upgrading that puppy food to an adult recipe. And when you're a business owner, it's the same thing. You understand that as your company grows, the cracks can start to emerge and your tasks can get more complicated. That's why you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have been upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. 1, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist, designed to give you consistently excellent performance, absolutely free, at netsuite.com/preet. That's netsuite.com/preet to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/preet. Jonathan Swan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I want to point out to people, because the story is unfolding as we speak, we are recording on Wednesday, November 9th at about 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The House has not been called.
The Senate has not been called. People think the House is leaning one way. There was all this talk about a red wave. Jonathan, as we speak in this moment, without everything being fully understood and certified, what happened to the red wave?
It didn't materialize. And it wasn't just a red wave. You had people like Ted Cruz declaring it was a red tsunami. It certainly wasn't. It's a tsunami got downgraded late last night about 11 p.m. People saying, oh, it's not a tsunami. Maybe it's a 20-foot wave. Oh, maybe it's... And now at this point, it sort of looks like a trickle into a puddle.
A ripple. I think it's a ripple.
A ripple might be the way to describe it. As you said, it's still waiting on a lot of California results, which sort of reminiscent of 2018. It looks like Republicans will take back the House, but with a narrow majority. And the Senate is really very up for grabs. We're looking at a very tight race in Nevada, Arizona as well. Democrats are feeling quite good about beating Blake Masters in the Arizona Senate. And Georgia looks like it's going to head to a runoff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a tight night.
Did something change, or did the pollsters and pundits just get it wrong?
They got it wrong.
Yeah.
And like, we should sort of pause for a second and say that some were worse than others. I got a text this morning from a senior Republican official and Trump advisor, and they said, if I ever hear the name Robert Kahaly again, I'm going to puke.
Who's that?
He is the guy who runs the esteemed Trafalgar poll, which basically was just completely inane. It had, you know, Republicans winning by these obscene margins. That's his thing. He always has Republicans winning. But of course, this garbage gets fed to Trump himself. So Trump loves Kahaly's, you know, numbers and polling because it's happy talk. And so part of the story is there is a loop of very bad information that got piped into not just Trump himself, but I think a lot of like senior Republicans were drinking the Kool-Aid. And I'll tell you, not to let them off the hook, like Democrats were very gloomy. And I'm not just talking about like, you know, rank and file members of Congress, but I'm talking about the people who are actually receiving the data, doing the polling, analyzing this stuff. So I'd say that, you know, while Democrats are feeling, you know, really good today or better than they expected to be feeling, it wasn't because of any great prescience on their behalf.
Aren't Democrats by and large, and no mail please, gloomy about these things? And negative outlook on how their politicians are going to do.
They do have that reputation. It's really funny, Preet. Like I was talking to one of my sources about this, and they were talking about the asymmetry between the two parties, which it doesn't just exist in the obvious ways that we talk about. You know, like Republicans are willing to do things in certain circumstances that Democrats wouldn't entertain. But one of the just of this attitude you just talked about, Democrats, you know, generally being kind of more gloomy. There's also a sort of, I don't know what the right word is. Look at the fundraising emails. Look at the comparison. Republican fundraising emails are like, you know, give me your money, you traitor. Stand with Mr. Trump, or we will put you on Don Jr.'s list and we'll line you up and you'll never speak to Trump. You know, Trump will never even look at you again. He hates you. You know, give us your money. Blah, blah. Democrats are like, I really hate to ask, but, you know, I'm humbly requesting that if you could please pitch in, you know, da, 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 da. And so, you know.
And some of them are like, disaster, we're going to lose, we're out of money.
Well, that's a sort of common fundraising trick. You saw that on the Republican side too, which is like, yeah, the sky's falling in. You know, you even saw that with some of these. So there's a bit of a difference there.
So let's talk about the reaction of one particular individual who has some decisions to make. There was a tweet this morning from Maggie Haberman, who said the following, quote, Trump is indeed furious this morning, particularly about Mehmet Oz, and is blaming everyone who advised him to back Oz, including his wife, describing it as not her best decision, end quote. What, in your understanding, is the former president's state of mind?
Maggie's right. He's very unhappy about this. And as usual, looking to blame other people. He was furious with Dr. Oz, or as now Trump now calls him, Mehmet Oz, which is a, you know, sort of
that's his name.
In the same emphatic way that he says Barack Hussein Obama.
Was he not told? Did Melania not tell him that he was Muslim?
Trump was angry with Oz. Basically, he started to have buyer's remorse almost immediately after he endorsed him because Oz almost lost even with Trump's endorsement. And Trump had to go in and sort of drop a nuclear bomb on Dave McCormick, who was seen as a much more electable candidate by Republicans. Then he gets to the general election and Oz starts distancing himself from Trump. And Trump was watching this with a sort of hawk eye, was getting increasingly annoyed by it. And, you know, Oz would do things like refuse to endorse Trump for 2024, et cetera, et cetera. So Trump was already agitated by this. And, you know, he's always looking for someone to blame. The two people who pushed Oz really hard and were probably most responsible for getting his for Trump to endorse him were Sean Hannity on Fox News and Melania, Trump's wife. So, you know, that would explain what Maggie tweeted there.
Well, he never takes personal responsibility. He was
correct.
Seen recently saying, well, if they lose, if they win, I deserve all the credit. If they lose, I deserve no blame. This is just of a piece with that, right?
Right. And what he's also trying to do is in his sort of post-results spin is claim that the people who lost, they lost because they backed away from his claims that the election was stolen. So, you know, in Trump's telling, the reason Republicans lost the New Hampshire Senate seat is because this wonderful gentleman who was so strong on election denial in the primary kind of wussed out in the general. And that's why, which is obviously an absurd reading of the situation.
Do you think Trump or the people around Trump have a concern that this election will be viewed by senior Republicans as a repudiation of Trump, or does he never think that way?
They 100%. I mean, it's not, do I think that? I mean, that is what is happening. They know that. And the people around him, his core political team are smart. I mean, these are not like, I mean, people like Susie Wiles, Chris Lacivita, Tony Fabrizio, Brian Jack. I mean, these are like smart, seasoned political operatives. So like, again, I'm not saying that any of them have told me this, but these are smart people who know what's going on and talk to and all basically have very broad and deep connections in the Republican Party. So they all know what's going on. Whether Trump himself sort of is going to change any of his plans, like announcing because of this, I don't know. There are certainly people around him who want him to delay his announcement. He, as he says, scheduled to make his quote unquote big announcement on November 15th. There are a number of people around him who want him to delay that until after the Georgia runoff. I don't know whether he does that or not.
So let's talk about that.
Sure.
There was some reporting the day before the election that Trump was really gearing up and was thinking about announcing for 2024, literally on the eve of the midterms. Any truth to that, to your knowledge?
He was. No, 100%. So that morning—
So why? What's the logic behind that?
Well, logic. So, so the morning of election eve, Trump was telling people that I'm just going to do it tonight in Ohio at the Ohio rally with J.D. Vance. And that set off panic stations and various people, including Lindsey Graham, were desperately trying to stop Trump from doing that because they were worried that it would energize Democratic voters, you know, and hurt them on election day. Ultimately, he was talked off that and ended up doing this, you know, announcing the announcement on that speech, which was sort of, I'm going to be making this announcement, but, you know, stopped short of doing it. But that was absolutely real. He was worried. His primary concern was him not getting credit for a good night. Everyone was expecting Republicans to have a huge night, and Trump was concerned that he wouldn't receive sufficient credit for it. So he wanted to get out in front of that and be able to say, well, they did so well because, you know, of me, my candidates, I announced,
right.
Blah, blah,
so
blah.
Suppose he had gotten out ahead of it, uh-huh. And then they had the mediocre and mixed mm-hmm. results that they got. Mm-hmm. That would have been worse for Trump, right?
Yes.
And we might have been able to say that some people went to the polls and voted for the other guy precisely because Trump had announced. So his people saved him.
Yes, his people did. Yep.
So knowing his psychology better than many people and the people around him, do you have a prediction on whether or not he changes his mind? Certainly he's not going to change his mind about running, right? Or do you think even that's in play?
I don't know. I really try, like it is so fraught trying to get into this stuff because he really changes his mind so frequently, and he can be talked out of certain things if he perceives that it's in his self-interest and they present to him that it's in his self-interest.
Right.
The thing you can be certain of is he's not going to do anything because it's in the party's interest.
Right.
But if
do the people around him want him to run, or are they just sort of obeying his own interest?
Depends who. It's not universal.
Is there a consensus? Is there a majority who
no,
want him?
No. And I think even, again, I I don't know this, but like, I don't even think you would find a consensus in his own family.
Or in his own head? His own head, perhaps?
No, I think he's pretty set on it. I don't think there's much doubt about that, but...
Why does he want to run again? To prove himself? For vengeance? To stay out of prison? A combination of those things?
Well, definitely the legal side of things is a reason for him to run. And I've talked to several of his advisors over the last few months who say that he thinks being a current political candidate is helpful in his battles with the Justice Department. He's convinced of that. So that's definitely a reason, but I think there's also another reason, which is just he has a burning desire to be back at the center of things and to vindicate himself and have a comeback and be, you know, he's addicted to attention, addicted to media attention. It's like a drug. And so you need ever larger doses of it. And he got the world's biggest dose you could possibly get as president of the United States. And I think it's a huge come down to kind of leave that. So I think that's part of it too.
Well, he's got Truth Social. That's something.
Is it though, Breen?
No, That was sarcasm. Mm. So he also never wants to look weak. And having said that he's going to announce on November 15th, knowing him, how does he put that off? Or I guess he can always come up with some excuse.
I mean, that's the reason why I'm still skeptical he'll change his plans, because I do think it would be a sign of weakness doing so. So
One reason for him to announce early, based on the people you talk to clear the field, scare people away?
That was, yes. Yeah. I mean, a big part of going early was Trump was going to, and he was going to put a lot of pressure on people to endorse him. I mean, he's going to, you know, people like Kevin McCarthy, well, you know, they were, you know, potentially going to be in this really difficult position where you had the most powerful person in your party kind of berating you to do a public endorsement. And you saw some people preemptively endorse him, like Carrie Lake said, you know, he hasn't even announced yet. She endorsed him.
Running for governor in Arizona.
Yes. And I think one of the biggest consequences of last night is he can't clear the field now. It has emboldened his rivals.
So let's go through this. I know people are going to be listening thinking, we don't even know about 2022 results yet. And already you're talking about 2024. But look, 2024 is important and 2022 affects 2024. So in your estimation, who doesn't get out at this point?
Who doesn't get out?
Yeah. In other words, who will put their hat in even if Trump puts his hat in?
Oh, I know the people who are thinking very, very seriously about challenging Trump.
Who are they?
Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, Glenn Youngkin. Those are Chris Christie.
Okay. Do you agree with me that all of those are ridiculous other than DeSantis?
No, I don't agree with you on that. I don't think
Pence is ridiculous, isn't it?
I don't think it's ridiculous.
Who is Mike Pence's? I'm not saying
he's going to win. And by the way, like I've spent enough time in politics to like really just not write people off because I've just seen enough. I think he was the sitting vice president and like I do think he's got some following. I'm not predicting that he can. I think he's going to be a very hard road to travel for him. But even DeSantis, like, you know, I think everyone's very, very high on DeSantis and they should be. You know, he had a huge thumping victory.
And they should be why, yeah. Describe from your perspective, for people who weren't following Florida so closely, what his accomplishment was in Florida.
Well, Florida has just become a deep red state. It's transformed. And what DeSantis has done is kind of remarkable. He's won counties that you just wouldn't have ever imagined, you know, 3-4 years ago would go red and has made huge inroads with Hispanics across the state. So he's turned Florida from a toss-up state into just an absolutely, you know, thumping victory. And he's done so by being very conservative, picking every culture war issue and, you know, turning it into policy and being sort of unapologetic about it. So yeah, no wonder he's seen as a front runner. That being said, he still never actually faced the kind of test that Trump will pose for him. Trump is going to be completely unrestrained in his attacks on Ron DeSantis.
I mean, he's already started, right? So let's talk about that.
He started in a very gentle way. It's going to get...
He referred to him as... Well, let's go through it. He refers to him as Ron DeSanctimonious. Got a laugh from the crowd at his rally. What's the strategy for Ron DeSantis in responding? Like, that's what I don't get. How does he even respond?
Well, he's responded in probably the best possible way, which is to say nothing.
Win his race.
And then to absolutely outpace Trump in Florida on a scale that's just, you just can't quarrel with it.
So he just has to grin and bear the insults and the slights.
I don't think that's sustainable. I think at some point, particularly for Republican primary voters who want to see toughness, at some point, you know, particularly if Trump starts, you know, talking about his wife, things like that. I mean, Trump said something to the effect of the other day to reporters, "I know more about him than anyone besides his wife, maybe his wife." And so, da, da, da. So if Trump starts doing a bit more of the wife stuff, you know, like it's sort of probably not tenable for Ron DeSantis to stay quiet, but that's obviously his strategy.
It's worked for Ted Cruz.
Has it though?
Well, I don't know. He's still in the Senate. Are there signs that within the Republican establishment, I don't just mean elected officials, but also the conservative media establishment, Fox News and other places, are you detecting any kind of shift away from Trump and towards DeSantis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, among Republican elites. Yeah. Well, the shift has already happened, mm-hmm. right? The shift happened about a year and a half ago. It started to happen. Murdoch turned against Trump. You started to see very negative coverage of Donald Trump in the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal editorial side of things. That's been going on for a long time. Fox News in the daytime hours has been turning against Trump and boosting DeSantis. You've seen a shift in tone in their morning Fox and Friends show with Steve Doocy becoming quite anti-Trump. And so you're seeing the shift happen. What hasn't shifted yet, and I don't know whether it will, is the really important piece of the Fox real estate, which is primetime. You haven't seen Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, or Tucker Carlson turn on Trump. And I think if you do see that, that will be meaningful with Republican primary voters. And then you've got the sort of conservative elite, you know, the donor community is with DeSantis. I mean, the big end donor community, they've had enough of Trump largely. Now, not many of them are brave enough to come out and say that yet, except for Ken Griffin, who is a big deal donor who's done that. But you may start to see now more donors emboldened to come out and sort of say, we need to move on from Trump. But a lot of these guys still have scar tissue from 2016 where they threw everything, you know, a lot of these donors spent quite a bit of money trying to beat Trump and got humiliated. So they're quite reticent to do that. And then you've got these sort of conservative influencer activists who, you know, there are some of them who have already sided with DeSantis, but there's still a fear of really, there's still a lot of people who are privately against Trump but afraid of going against him publicly because there is a disconnect between Republican elite opinion and the base. Yeah. There just is. Yeah. And I constantly talk to these Republicans in DC, the sort of professional Republican consultant class, who, you know, they've got their views and whatever. And none of them were there, you know, I was, you know, whatever, two months ago, you know, in the stadium arena in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, 10,000 people packed to the rafters, fervent Trump fans, and you know, just complete different universe. So he still has a very, very strong base. And there's going to be a lot of people who are saying, you know, rest in peace, Donald Trump. This is the end of Donald Trump. It's completely misguided, in my opinion. I don't think we've seen any evidence to support such declarative statements.
You don't see any fatigue in Trump's base?
In his base? Not a huge amount.
No.
Not a huge amount. It's not coming through. I mean, there has been a little bit of slippage, but the strongest fatigue is among Republican elites.
Is there anyone that the Trump people are more worried about than DeSantis?
No.
And who are they worried about second most?
I don't hear him worried about anyone second most.
So if there was no DeSantis, Trump would likely just trot to the nomination, right?
You just never know. And again, like, I'm sorry to be annoying, but I just—
No,
like,
it's smart.
I've seen enough. Yeah, I mean,
you can't say I told you so in 2 years.
No, but it's also just like, you know, things change. But that's certainly their view anyway. The only person that they see right now as a really serious threat is Ron DeSantis.
Do you think they're already thinking about, and then we'll talk about other things. Do you think that the Trump folks are already thinking about a running mate?
No, he's not. I mean, this is another thing that I think has been misreported.
Yeah.
Trump doesn't think he needs a VP. He's not like Trump sitting around saying, oh, who do I need who's going to help me win with, you know, Hispanic women? Or he doesn't think, like, Trump thinks he's—
Is that your Trump voice, Jonathan? Is that your Trump voice?
No, it's my shit, this crappy Australian.
That was
Trump thinks he's the greatest political candidate that's ever existed in world history. And the idea of a vice president is sort of an inconvenience. And he doesn't want someone who's going to upstage him or try to upstage him. He wants someone who's completely loyal. So I think he's not really drawing up lists or things. I think it's very premature, that conversation about a running mate.
So all this conjecture among the talking heads about Carrie Lake and Nikki Haley.
It's just conjecture. It's just conjecture.
And there's—
he likes her. He thinks she's great. He thinks Carrie Lake's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And there's a good— I understand why people think she might be SVP. She might be. But I think it's conjecture rather than reporting.
Is there any universe in which, instead of there being this fight, or at least a forever fight between DeSantis and Trump, they team up on a ticket?
Nope.
Like Kennedy, Kennedy and Johnson? Because it's happened
before. See it. I think that's—
Because
really
of Trump.
Yes.
Because of Trump's intransigence on it.
I don't know that DeSantis would want that either, but I just don't know. But I don't see Trump— I don't see a universe in which Trump picks DeSantis as his VP.
Who's the Democrat that the Trump folks are most concerned about? Is it Biden or someone else?
That's a good question. I don't ever hear them express concern about the Democrats, to be honest with you. I think that they look at the Democratic field and see a lot of weakness and problems. I think that they see Biden as a very, very weak incumbent president, and Harris as— Trump's dream, I think, would be to run against Kamala Harris in a general election. So I never hear them fret about a Democrat.
But might they fret a little bit more after the mixed results from the midterms, or no?
They might. I just haven't got any reporting to share on that. Like, I haven't heard anything from them on that.
We'll be right back with my conversation with Jonathan Swan after this.
That guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
What are some of the other races that you think people are most surprised about in this midterm?
Well, I think Republicans are generally surprised by the softness of their performance. Pennsylvania was disastrous, not unexpectedly so at the gubernatorial level, but, you know, the Senate there was, they underperformed expectations. New Hampshire was a complete dumpster fire. Again, not a complete shock, but the scale of it, I think, was a shock. They expected to do better in Georgia with Herschel Walker. They expected to do— they're still hopeful in Nevada with Laxalt. But
they really expected to do that much better in Georgia, given how poor a candidate, I think, consensus tells us.
Yeah, because they were so— they thought the environment was so good that and Kemp was running so strongly that they thought that Herschel—
Well, he decisively beat Stacey Abrams.
Yes, he did.
And people split their vote.
That's right. And they didn't think that there would be as much of that as there ended up being.
So that's almost certainly going to run off Warnock and Walker.
Yeah. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, without Kemp on the ballot in a runoff and without the independent candidate, is there an assessment about who that favors?
I don't know. That's going to be like the most expensive runoff in American history. It'll be, you know,
to keep running again and again.
I mean, you just can't even imagine how much money will get spent in that. If it's deciding the Senate, it's just stunning amounts of money. They were very surprised in the underperformance in Arizona.
Yeah, talk about Arizona for a moment.
Although, Carrie, like the latest I'm hearing, like an hour before we talked, is there's still a decent chance that Carrie Lake wins at the gubernatorial
the governorship. And what about the Senate race?
The Senate's looking better for Democrats. They're cautiously optimistic that Kelly's going to hang on, but it's close. Yeah. So Arizona.
Pause on Arizona for one more second.
Yeah,
that's the race in which the Democrat, Katie Hobbs, refused to debate. Did that make any sense to you?
This is not my opinion. This is a Democrat's opinion, was that she might have been the worst candidate that they put up anywhere at that level. Just completely inept at public advocacy.
And leadership. Oh, those are not important qualities for someone running for statewide office.
But maybe it was the right tactical decision.
Yeah.
It might have ended up being, you know, she did better than people expected. And perhaps if she stood next to the person who's had 25, 26 years of daily training on local television and got completely annihilated, that might have harmed her. You know, they obviously made a tactical decision that it was better to take the hits on not debating than actually be seen debating.
Right. It was the opposite strategic decision from Pennsylvania.
Right.
Where John Fetterman, who's still suffering the effects of a stroke,
right,
chose to debate. And a lot of people questioned that. Do you have a view on that decision? I mean, ultimately he won. So maybe it was a good decision.
I mean, he benefited hugely from having Mastriano was just such a drag on that ticket.
The governor's race helped Fetterman.
The governor's race. And Shapiro was so strong. Yeah. I mean, he's a potential presidential candidate. He just did so, so well. So yeah, look, I don't know. That debate was obviously not good for Fetterman, but maybe debates don't matter as much as we think they do.
They may not. And, you know, you mentioned Shapiro in Pennsylvania as a future star. Any other future stars? My mind goes to
I think Whitmer's
in Michigan.
For
prevailing.
Yeah.
What about? Well, tell me about Whitmer, and then I want you to say
something.
No,
I just think she's a very compelling. Look, the truth about this moment right now in politics is, unfortunately, I think it's not great for like anyone, but a lot of it just comes down to television performance and social media and, you know, what you look like on screen and how you perform in the media. And she's a very strong performer, and like that goes a long way. It just does now. So for that reason alone, not to mention her opponent was actually seen as a pretty good candidate. And she, you know, she convincingly won.
It's not always, you know, the counterexample I think of, and I was talking about him earlier today, was the governor, the reelected governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, who is not particularly telegenic or amazing on television. He's kind of a boring, technocratic, moderate guy. And he outperformed J.D. Vance.
In a state that's just, you know, deep, deep red. And J.D. Vance's challenges were widespread. I mean, it's kind of amazing. I suppose it happened because Trump endorsed him, but like he had so many problems with Republican base voters initially because of his litany of public condemnations of Donald Trump, you know, in very kind of vivid terms. So he had to overcome that. Tim Ryan is a very good candidate as well, by the way. Like,
excellent.
That should not be underestimated. Tim Ryan, you know, Republicans anyway, I don't know, I haven't talked to enough Democrats about this to know, but I'll just tell you, like, senior Republicans, people running a lot of big races considered Tim Ryan to be one of the best candidates anywhere that Democrats were running. So actually, I think J.D. Vance did fine.
But it's interesting about Ohio because there's a guy named Sherrod Brown.
Right.
Who's pretty liberal. Who wins in that red state and a pretty good candidate also. And Tim Ryan couldn't do what Sherrod Brown is able to do every 6 years.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the next time he has to come. Sherrod Brown has such a distinct brand. Yeah. I mean, he is just, you know, he's almost sui generis. Like, it's like talking about Joe Manchin in West Virginia kind of thing. So,
like John Tester in Montana.
Yeah, yeah. There are a few Susan Collins in Maine. Like, there are a few politicians that have this extremely distinct brand and can overcome just basic kind of political dynamics, generic ballot dynamics, you know, pure partisanship.
Any other stars on the Republican or Democratic side? The person I wanted to mention is Wes Moore, first black governor in Maryland. Anyone else strike you as a future person?
I think Spanberger is really like winning again, and in such a tough environment. I don't know what her future holds, but people are very impressed by her. So she's someone who's on my radar. But yeah, like the names I hear most are Shapiro and Whitmer, for sure.
I want to go ahead and talk about 2024 again for a minute. Do you think people have learned, the people who might choose to challenge Donald Trump, have they learned something about the most effective way to debate him? Or is he just not really debatable?
It's a really good question. It's funny, when I talk to some of his prospective rivals, you can see that they're like, I've had conversations with, well, one of his rivals anyway, where they've like played out scenes in the debate. Like, you could tell they're fantasizing about debating him, and like they've thought through, you know, all these.
Are you talking about Chris Christie?
I couldn't possibly comment.
That sounds like Chris Christie.
Well, you can say that. I'm not going to say that. So yes, some people have been thinking about that, and you know, I often hear different strategies, you know, of what would work and what not. Most of it's just gut instinct. It's not being polled or anything like that. Like, I often hear this refrain, which is just to say, you're a loser. You lose. You know, the party lost the House. They lost the Senate. You lost the White House. You know, who else could have lost to Joe Biden? You know, blah, blah, blah.
What's Trump's response to that?
I think that's why people think that's quite a potent line. And probably the person who's best positioned to deliver that is Ron DeSantis at this point.
Because he's a winner. Victory. Whether you like it or not, he is.
Right. There's also the other thing I hear from some Republicans who potentially would challenge him is they do see an opening to go at him from the right, which is, and what that looks like is to say, you know, you were too eager to listen to Anthony Fauci, you shut the government down, you let all these criminals out of prison because you listened to woke Jared Kushner. You know, all these drug dealers, we've got a fentanyl problem, and you know, you let all these, you know, you pardoned a drug trafficker. Oh, by the way, all these woke generals you complain about, you're the one who promoted them. You know, there's that kind of a line. I don't know whether that works or not, but that's certainly something I hear Republicans toss around as a possible, you know, attack against Trump.
Let me ask you another version of the question of whether people have learned how to debate Trump. And it's whether you've learned, or the press corps has learned over the last 5, 6, 7 years, the best way to interview a politician who may not be forthcoming and truth-telling. You and I have had a couple of conversations that have been very interesting about the best way to interview somebody, being respectful, but pinning them down. And I think you're one of the best in the business when it comes to live interviews of powerful people. How have you thought about that? How have you evolved in your thinking about how to do that?
I think the first decision is whether you interview them or not. And that's actually a really important decision. What's the purpose of you? What am I actually trying to accomplish by doing this interview? And once you've answered that question, you just have to really prepare. I mean, seriously prepare, because it's just, you're dealing with someone who is just going to, like, you talk about Trump, he doesn't really answer questions. You know, you could ask him any question about, you know, present any evidence you want about, you know, there being, yes, no, it turns out that the Iranians were not inside the Dominion machines and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he will just assert, no, have you seen the video of the Italian satellites and did it? Well, no, that's not.
And you can't argue.
You end up in this, it just becomes this, like, you're whacking down and he puts up another one, or what about the suitcases under the table? And at some point you think to yourself, what's the point? I mean, what's the point of this? What purpose am I serving by conducting this? So I think the first thing is to kind of think through, well, is there something that he hasn't been pressed on, hasn't been held accountable on, that's actually worthwhile trying to do that? Or am I just kind of giving a platform to someone to steamroll through and say what he's going to say and whatever? And, you know, those are not easy decisions. And
is there someone on the scene at this moment, Trump or otherwise, who you would not interview for that reason?
No. I kind of, no, like probably not. I mean, I'd love to interview Carrie Lake. I think there's a way to do that. And I mean, she's probably the best example. And I've seen people shy away from interviewing her because, you know, she declares all sorts of things that are false about the 2020 election. And she's extremely good at it. I mean, if you do local television every day for 20 plus years, you're going to get good at it. And she's also naturally good at it. And so I think there's an intimidation factor there, but I do think there's a way to interview her with facts, soberly, kind of thinking through lines of questioning, et cetera. So there's no one I can think of that I wouldn't interview. I mean, there is probably to the extent that, like, you know, do you want to, I mean, I remember looking back at old Mike Wallace interviews when he had this show called Nightbeat, which was before he started 60 Minutes. And it was this really amazing, awesome interview show. It was kind of pioneered television interviewing in the way that we understand it now. Sort of nasty questions, adversarial, but really sharp and smart. And it was this set, it was under really bright, unforgiving lights, and you could close ups, you'd see the faces sweat. He interviewed like a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan on that show. And they're there with that pointy hat on and whatever. So like, would I interview someone like that who's just going to like spew absolute bile and whatever? Probably not. I don't know that there's much of a public interest reason to do that. So you do make, you know, decisions like that. But in terms of like powerful people and people who are running for office and who are in office, I don't rule anyone out. I wouldn't have any, I refuse to interview this person because they—
So once you decide, once you make the decision to interview someone, in your case, it's most people.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you have a particular strategy that you employ?
Yeah. Yeah, I think through what's the point of this interview? What's the purpose of this interview? And if I can't answer that question, I won't request the interview. Once I've answered that question, there's usually some line of questioning that I think of as the heart of the interview. What's the thing that, like, if I could do nothing else, if I could just ask one line of questioning, what would that be? With Mitch McConnell, who I interviewed earlier this year, the heart of that interview, and it ended up being, I think, pretty exceptional interview, immodestly, was me teasing out with him the contradiction or the tension between him giving this very impassioned speech on the Senate floor, saying that Trump was practically and morally responsible for the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and then 2 weeks later going on Fox News and saying that he would absolutely support Donald Trump if he's the Republican nominee in 2024. Yeah. And I'd thought through that line of questioning very deeply, and McConnell said, you know, I don't think it's any great surprise that, you know, the leader of the Republican Party would support the Republican. And I said, I think it's astonishing after saying that. And what I'd never seen before from anyone interviewing Mitch McConnell, and I watched all the tape, you know, everyone asks when they interview McConnell, they ask the same, it's all about legislative strategy. What's going to happen with Build Back Better? I mean, who gives a crap what's going to happen? Like, he's not going to support Build Back Better. You know, why don't you think a bit bigger than that and think about some of these questions that maybe they've got a moral dimension to them. Maybe there's something that ordinary people, if they would sit in front of him, you're the representative of normal people out there, and you think to yourself, well, if they were sitting in this chair, what would they want to ask if they were here? It's a really great responsibility, actually, when you're lucky enough to get that access to a powerful person, and you're sitting there and you've got this precious time with them. So every line of questioning matters. Every line of questioning burns up 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And then before you know it, the interview's over. And you probably, if you've done a decent job of it, you may never get another chance to interview them ever again. I mean, I think I'm a very fair interviewer. I don't do cheap shots. I don't do stuff that's gimmicky. And I think I do it in a way that's respectful, very respectful, as you should be. You shouldn't be disrespectful to people who you're interviewing, no matter who they are. But, you know, the fact is when you do a tough interview with someone, it's harder to book interviews in the future. So that's a problem that I've—
Well, you use a technique that I've commented on before and that we use in trial. And I think you'd be a great trial lawyer. And that is just the simple approach of asking a question, and when you don't get an answer, you just ask the same question again.
Right.
And when you don't get an answer, you ask the same question again. It's very effective, and it makes people squirm because their evasiveness is put on display. So I think that's a good thing that you do.
And you use silence. Silence is such an underused tool in television interviewing. It's an incredibly effective tool because most people, not all people, most people become incredibly uncomfortable in silence and feel the need to fill the space. And that's sometimes when you get your most interesting material, is when you shut your mouth and you just let it breathe for a moment. Good job.
I was employing your technique.
It's good.
In real time. Were you getting nervous, Jonathan?
I actually was. I was getting nervous.
Were you fretting a little bit?
Yeah. I was like, what do I say now?
That was kind of impressive. I'm going to use that a lot more often. I'm going to just be silent. People like,
yeah.
No, but in the modern day, because we're not in person, you just say, like, I think you hit mute by accident. It's hard to tell the difference between strategic use of silence and the accidental pushing of mute.
Mm. Mm.
Is there a favorite interview that you've done and or a least favorite interview you've done?
I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say that the famous Trump interview in 2020 was my favorite. It was my favorite interview because it just reached so many people, had such an impact. I think they figured out that 100 million people ended up watching all or part of that interview. It was in terms of sharing and different clips and things like that. So, and I would just, it was just astonishing. It had global reach. It was an incredible interview. But other interviews that I've really felt that I've done as well, basically most interviews I walk away with disappointed with myself. That I look back and I watch the tape and I think, oh, I missed this opportunity. And my dad's a very good interviewer back in Australia. And he, you know, sort of probably in some ways, I've got his voice in my head a little bit as well in terms of being critical of myself. Interviews where I've walked away thinking, you know, I did a really good job. Donald Trump, Jared Kushner in 2019, Imran Khan in Pakistan last year that actually caused street protests. People were protesting at what he said about women, basically blaming them for being sexually assaulted, for wearing provocative clothing. That was a very well-executed interview. Mitch McConnell, the Chinese ambassador who I did in 2019, I think, or 2020. That was a really strong interview. So those are probably some of my favorites, but my least favorite interview is just when they're programmed and talking points, like Tom Perez. I mean, good Lord. Like, I just like, say something
former
real,
labor,
man.
Former labor
yeah.
President.
It's like, good my God. The people who are just so programmed, you just cannot get them to say anything that's not pre-scripted talking points. You just think, well, what am I, this is pointless for everyone involved. So there's been a few of them, but I don't want to start listing them because I don't want to offend people.
You can tell me after we hit the stop button. We've got to let you go, but how do you think this has gone? I don't think this is my best, but it's not my worst.
I think he could have been tougher on me, honestly.
Yeah, you know, this is in the nature of sort of a postmortem of the election.
Yeah.
We'll have you back and I think you could do something more
adversarial. Yeah.
Would you like that?
No. I honestly would hate it.
Why?
I probably wouldn't go on.
Would you agree to be interviewed by someone who's like you?
I wouldn't want to be interviewed in general. Like, I don't do many of these things, these podcasts. I like, you know.
You like to be the one asking the questions.
Yeah, I don't think it's like good for me to be sort of talking about myself or like, it's just not a good thing. Like, I'm not scared of being interviewed, but I just think inherently when you're sitting down talking for long periods of time and you're a reporter, it's bad and dangerous. And I've probably said something stupid in this conversation.
No,
I'll regret.
So. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And I think you did a fine job.
All right. Thanks, man.
Jonathan Swan, keep it up. We'll talk
Thanks,
soon.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guest, Jonathan Swan. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. The CAFE team is David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Sean Walsh, Namita Shah, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.